Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the standoff between Judge Kavanaugh and his accuser, Professor Christine Ford, who wants an FBI investigation before testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which President Trump is denying her, offering the most flimsy of excuses. Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University and author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges, joins us to discuss whether Professor Ford's lawyers are overplaying their hand in making demands on the U.S. Senate, whose members are notorious for guarding their privileges and protocols. With Senator Graham warning bluntly that if Professor Ford does not show up to testify on Monday, the committee will go ahead and vote on Wednesday. We'll assess the chances of a compromise since the excuses for not having a quick investigation by the FBI, then a hearing, don't add up. But in the meantime, Professor Ford has had to go into hiding due to death threats, hacking, and impersonation online, and with the senile patriarch, Senator Hatch, already calling her mixed up. A repeat of the treatment Anita Hill got might not play too well in the Me Too era and further erode the chances of Republican women remaining loyal to Donald Trump's GOP at the polls in November. Then we'll examine the looming collision, if not a constitutional crisis, resulting from President Trump's order to declassify secret work product of an ongoing investigation in which the president himself might be a target. Andy Wright, a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters, joins us. We will discuss the possibility that both the director of the FBI and the director of national intelligence will be forced to resign to protect intelligence sources and methods from a cynical attempt by Trump to bolster conspiracy theories cooked up by Fox News and the so-called Freedom Caucus in the House. Then finally, we will look into the deal Russia's President Putin has made with Turkey's President Erdogan to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe by setting up a buffer zone on Turkey's southern border for 3 million Syrian citizens trapped with the remnants of the jihadist opposition to the Assad regime. An expert on U.S.-Turkey relations, Aaron Stein, a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Hariri Center for the Middle East, joins us to assess whether the plan is workable and how much the U.S. has been sidelined in the region by Russia's diplomatic initiatives. And joining us now is Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. And his latest book out in 2 weeks is Originalism as Faith. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Glad to be back, Ian. Thanks for having me.
So given the title of your book, of course, one wonders what the hell they're doing there on Capitol Hill, confirming anybody, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But let's deal with the crisis of the moment, if you will. I noticed on MSNBC last night they were all just absolutely giddy that this situation with the lawyers for the witness saying she's not going to show up to testify on Monday before the Senate Judiciary Committee unless there's an FBI investigation into her claims. But Senator Lindsey Graham basically said, look, if she doesn't show up on Monday, we're going to vote on Wednesday. And I'm wondering whether the lawyers for the accuser have overplayed their hand. My understanding of the Senate is that they don't like anybody questioning their prerogatives. And the idea that somebody's telling them what to do, I think, gets stuck in their craw. How do you see it?
Well, a couple of things. First, no one should be giddy about anything involving any of this. That's the first thing. This is just a sad situation all the way around. It's sad if she's telling the truth. It's sad if she's lying. It's sad if the truth is somewhere in between. It's just sad. So that's my first comment about this. My second comment is I don't know. I think the request for an FBI investigation, Ian, this is one of those situations where we have to be able to hold a number of different ideas in our head at the same time. There's no soundbite that I can give you to answer your question. It's a complicated thing. I think there's a lot to be said for having an independent investigation into her allegations, into his denials. That there's something to be said for that. There's something to be said that it should be done quickly. I don't know. I represent the FBI when I work for the Department of Justice. I feel like a week could have been a sufficient time, depending on the facts, if they had started right away and moved forward. What is now concerning me, and again, I want to be clear about holding different ideas in our head at the same time. She might very well be telling the truth. I tend to believe her. But maybe that this has now been taken over by people with motives separate from why she came forward to begin with. And you know my politics. You know, I'm progressive all the way down. But the Democrats may have seized upon this now to force a delay, you know, for all kinds of political reasons, and that's sad, too. That's not fair to Kavanaugh if she's not telling the truth, and I'm the last person who wants to be fair to Kavanaugh. I've been against him from the beginning. I think he lied 3 minutes after being introduced by the president. I think he lied about a lot of things during his testimony, so I'm not sympathetic to him, but there's two parts of fairness here. So the whole thing is a mess. So what I think obviously should happen if there were grown-ups in the room is there should be an independent investigation. It should be done quickly. Doesn't have to be by Monday, but it should be done as quickly as possible. And then the Senate should make its decision. One of the reasons the Republicans probably want to go fast on this is if it's just he said, she said, if that's all we're going to get in this, well, then the Republicans are going to have the votes. And it strikes me as very unlikely, absent further proof or evidence, that anything is going to change.
Well, something's already changed with the life of the accuser. She initially wrote to her congresswoman but demanded anonymity, and apparently that was the understanding that Senator Feinstein had when she got the letter. She didn't want to share it with her colleagues based upon the fact that Christine Blasey Ford, the California psychology professor, did not want to go public. But she's now had to move out of her home. She's been attacked, death threats, etc., hacked.
And that's tragic, too. I mean, that's just so tragic.
Yeah. So that's, I guess that's our tribal politics at play. But I find it pretty hard to accept President Trump's sort of somewhat fatuous notion that, oh, for some reason or other, the FBI can't investigate. I mean, they've done six investigations. They can't investigate. That doesn't fly.
But that's wrong. He's just lying. But that's, you know, he lies every day. So that's not a surprise. Obviously, they could investigate.
Right.
Can I make one editorial comment, Ian, that you didn't ask me, but I just can't resist?
Go ahead.
I mean, one of the many different aspects of this that is so troubling, and this is obviously self-serving for my agenda, but one of the things this shows us is the Supreme Court is too important in our lives. It's just too important. These nomination fights are out of control. You know, and they wouldn't be this bad if the court didn't interfere. And I'm talking about nonpartisan here, liberal, conservative. If the court didn't interfere so grossly in our lives so often, this wouldn't be quite as bad. If they didn't have life tenure, an idea I've been pushing for about a decade, but it's finally now getting some traction out there in the world, this wouldn't be as important. This whole episode is telling us a lot about men and women, I think, a lot about the Senate, and a lot about the Supreme Court.
And, of course, we are, I think, among the very few nations, if not the only nation, that has lifetime tenure for federal judges.
The only democracy in the world. I learned last week that Iran has life tenure for judges, and that should tell you something.
So, well, but just on the surface, though, Sandra Day O'Connor, unfortunately, she would still be on the Supreme Court, but for her husband having Alzheimer's, and then she felt she had to be with him, and she asked the Chief Justice Rehnquist whether he wanted to resign. If he wanted to resign, then she'd stay on. And he said, no, I'm fine.
You can go. Died.
And then died. She goes. Yes. She resigns, and of course her husband doesn't even recognize her. So we lost her as a kind of center-right moderate. Kennedy was always referred to as a swing vote, although I think he was fairly conservative. This guy is nothing like a replacement for Kennedy. I mean, even though Kennedy,
I've been screaming from the hills, and it got picked up by a few outlets. His answer to the question about Griswold versus Connecticut, the contraception case, was very, very terrifying. And no Democrats followed up, and I don't understand why. I can go into that if you want, real quickly. I mean, you know, that case struck down Connecticut's anti-contraception law. It involved the right to privacy, which became the foundation of Roe versus Wade. and the court didn't really know how to write it, but it found a right to privacy. Justice White concurred not on the right to privacy. He said a better crafted law would be a rational way to do this if it only applied to non-married people, forbidding them from using contraceptives. Kavanaugh said he agreed with Justice White's opinion in that case. Justice White dissented in Roe versus Wade. Justice White dissented in every abortion case. And he wrote Bowers versus Hardwick, which held that gays and lesbians had no right to private consensual intimacy in their own homes. He told us exactly who he was when he said, and he's the first person I've heard in public say this in 30 years, that he agreed with Justice White in Griswold. And that means he's agreeing with the dissenter in Roe and the author of Bowers versus Hardwick, a case that has lived in, well, it was an infamous case at the Supreme Court before it was reversed.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. And his latest book out in 2 weeks is Originalism as Faith. So this is a, you know, Handmaid's Tale type of attitude, right? That's as hard as it gets, because I've always wondered why it is that anti-abortion people are also against contraception, because contraception is what prevents abortions. It's never made any sense.
I can explain that to you, I think.
Go ahead.
And I say this as, I need to reveal my biases first. I am, of course, pro-choice all the way down, and I volunteered for Planned Parenthood. A lot of the anti-Roe versus Wade and anti-Casey, which is the real case that is binding now, movement is not based on anti-abortion or anti-contraception. It's based on anti-sex in a very traditional way. A lot of that movement is about don't have sex until you're married, and we're going to try. Now, I know that sounds crazy in 2018 America, but remember, it's the evangelicals and the far-right Republicans, not the moderate Republicans, who are behind this movement. And I don't know anything about their private lives. I'm guessing they're very inconsistent with this idea, but they really want to pretend that Americans don't and shouldn't have sex until after marriage. And that's a big part of the movement, Ian. I really think that's true.
Well, look at what the accuser is saying. When she was 15, Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge tried to rape her, but for the fact that they were so drunk, she would have been raped, apparently. Mark Judge has written books that entirely buttress the environment in which this situation was supposed to have happened, you know, about being a falling down drunk. One of the characters he refers to in his novel about Georgetown Prep was Bart O'Kavanaugh, who puked in somebody's car and was so drunk he couldn't walk home. So that's their sort of swirling around this thing. And then, of course, there's a clip of Kavanaugh saying recently, what went on at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep, to, of course, right, gales of laughter. So is this a situation of this sort of, I mean...
I know what you're saying, and it's hard to describe it.
Well, yeah, and particularly Mark Judge, because he apparently, in his second book about Georgetown Prep, he talked about what he called the Lavender Mafia, which is the number of gay priests that were trying to seduce boys at the Catholic boys' school. But he became a real hard right talk show kind of conservative writer, filmmaker, author. And his interpretation of the fact that there were all of these gay priests in the Catholic Church, and we know the extent to which that has become a global scandal, he attributes it all to liberalism in the 1960s, when in fact it's so obvious that it's the conservatives in the Catholic Church who are the problem. They're the ones behind the cover-ups, and they're the ones involved in the denial about the problem in the first place. So,
of course,
how
that's
do you,
true. I mean,
I don't understand, and a listener recently wrote to me saying, you don't understand conservatives. I wish I did.
I don't know. You're a little bit above my pay grade there. I will say that some people on people I respect on Twitter today and I were having a conversation that one of the issues here about the Supreme Court, and especially Republican nominees, you know, Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, they seem to be cut from a similar Ivy League preppy kind of male bonding. You know, Alito was in that private club at Princeton and all that. And that's, for if nothing else, that's not a good way to staff the highest court on the land that is supposed to be a counter-majoritarian institution reflecting not the electorate's values, but some other, you know, other constitutional values. This guy, Kavanaugh, he was introduced by President Trump. And within 2 minutes, he told a Trump-like lie. He said, this president has consulted with more people about this nomination than any president in history. We should have stopped right there. Honestly, in what kind of world are we living in? When a nominee to the Supreme Court, he was asked about that during the hearing. He had no data, no evidence, no support for that statement. I'm going to start to rant. It was incredibly arrogant, and it's probably demonstrably false. We should have stopped right there. But there is a sense of entitlement that these people have. I wouldn't put Roberts in this category, but Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, Roberts comes from the Midwest. He comes from a slightly different, but those three have this sense of I'm going to say it, white male privilege that is just, whether it's good or bad, the Supreme Court should be more diverse than that. And that's one of the big things going on here. And I think that is one of the things that has triggered so much anger and, you know, anger on the part of the Democrats. And, of course, we have to throw into this mix the Garland fiasco, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what Obama did is nominated a very moderate, to the right of Justice Scalia on criminal procedure issues, a very moderate justice trying to bring the two sides together. A guy who Republicans, who Orrin Hatch had said was obviously a quality individual, and he wouldn't even get a hearing. This is all a perfect storm of events leading to the current disaster that we are in, and I don't know how we're going to get out of it very easily.
Well, but the one thing about these men that you're talking about, Roberts, Thomas, Alito, and...
Well, no, I wouldn't put Thomas in the category of... No one has written more critically about Justice Thomas than I have, but he's not like Kavanaugh, and he's not like Gorsuch, and he's not like Alito. He comes from a very different time and place. I don't want to put Thomas in there.
But I was about to say that Thomas and now Kavanaugh are all very, very right-wing Catholics. And most of the Catholics in this country are, I think, are much more liberal, just as the right-wing Jewish lobby in this country is more powerful than the fact that, what, three-quarters of American Jewry are liberal and vote Democrat. So you have a...
I'm not sure that's accurate about Thomas, Ian. I thought I've read and heard over the years. He votes that way. I don't know if he's a religious Catholic. I don't know if that's true. I have some reason to think that maybe not be true. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, yeah, because his wife's certainly an Episcopalian, and he was defended by Senator Danforth, who was a very prominent Episcopalian. And Gorsuch's wife's Episcopalian, and they apparently go to an Episcopalian church. But they definitely have a right-wing take on religion as opposed to the more generous, loving prophet that Jesus actually was. So that's another conversation. Well, let's not get into theology.
Although I agree with you. I agree with you 100% about that, but I do think it's on the conversation.
Sure.
I agree. Do you have any thoughts on how this is going to end?
Well, that was exactly the question I was about to ask you, because I'm afraid that the lawyers for the accuser may have overplayed their hand. I don't know that the Republicans aren't going to just basically say, if you don't show up on Monday, we're going to go ahead and vote on Wednesday. You know, that's how they've been all along. I mean, McConnell and company, it's just a bunch of thugs. They basically wouldn't let any of Obama's judicial appointments go through, or very few. They held them up. So the massive backlog, which now Trump is filling on the federal courts with highly unqualified far-right types. And then, of course, you mentioned Merrick Garland, which is an outrage and completely unprecedented. So they've shown that they're shameless. So I wouldn't discount the fact that they could probably just say...
Well, here's my one caveat to all that, and I think you're probably right. There might be a reason to think that if that plays out that way, women will be even more disaffected come November. And that might be something they're thinking. So some of the more either moderate, I'm not sure that's the right definition of that, but maybe one or two of the more reasonable, like Jeff Flake from Arizona, Republicans on the committee might be worried he's not running for re-election. But my point is, this could have a pretty serious effect on women, you know, in November. And if that's true, if I'm right about that, they might be concerned about that. They probably want Supreme Court justice more. How do you think? I think this might play out badly for them in November if it goes that way. I think women are pretty fed up as it is.
Sure. And Christine Ford essentially said, her lawyer said that Orrin Hatch has referred to Christine Ford as maybe being mixed up, suggesting that she's not imbalanced, echoes again of his attacks on Anita Hill.
Right.
That hyper patriarchal attitude. So maybe if she doesn't show on Monday and they can't get an FBI inquiry in together, there will be a big cloud hanging over it. Apparently, she'd make a very good witness from what I'm told, so it would be a pity.
The one takeaway I hope your listeners get from this, there are so many different angles, and let's be clear, we don't know who's telling the truth. I mean, you and I don't know who's telling the truth, so we shouldn't, you know, I tend to believe her, but I don't think women make these things up, but you and I weren't there and we don't know. But there is one thing. Again, the stakes of Supreme Court nominations are too high. And the reason they're too high is because life tenure on this institution carries too much power. And if that isn't clear from this process, I don't know how to make it more clear. I mean, we're fighting over one of nine positions, all nine, have just way too much power for a representative democracy. I'm sorry, that's my rant, but I think it should be pretty obvious. That's what we're fighting over here.
Well, Eric Siegel, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Siegel. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. And his latest book out in 2 weeks is Originalism as Faith. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the possibility that both the director of the FBI and the director of National Intelligence will be forced to resign to protect sources and methods from a cynical attempt by Trump to bolster a conspiracy theory cooked up by Fox News and the so-called Freedom Caucus in the House.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down. Say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Wright.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
So, given Woodward's book suggests that the chief staff of the White House refers to the White House and Washington in general during the Trump administration as crazy town. Today, there was an extraordinary manifestation of crazy town where the President of the United States, in an interview on Hill TV, said that he doesn't have an attorney general. And I find this extraordinary that the President of the United States keeps saying he doesn't have an attorney general, because Sessions doesn't protect him rather than uphold the laws of the United States and protect and defend the Constitution. So isn't the president, by implication, even more so, I think, rather boldly stating that the attorney general's job is to protect him from the law as opposed to uphold the law?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the President of the United States has an obligation to follow and defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. He also has an obligation under the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And in this circumstance, he continues to act like the Justice Department is supposed to be giving him fealty like an old monarch rather than doing the job, which is following the law and the facts wherever they take them, because we live in a country that was founded on the principle that we had a rule of law and not a rule of a man. And so it's quite concerning that even, you know, this far into his administration, he hasn't started to appreciate sort of the basic role that he has vis-a-vis America's criminal laws and enforcers of them.
But why do you think this is not pointed out and hasn't become an issue, particularly with the Congress, since so many members of the House and Senate are in fact lawyers? I mean, to me, isn't this a fundamental foundation of the law?
Well, I think it's a bedrock part of the rule of law, and I'm quite concerned about the lack of signaling from Congress that there are limits to the president's ability to micromanage the Justice Department or apply a very self-interested view of what their role is. And you know, it's Congress's job, beyond the partisanship, to protect the institutions and structures of our government. And right now, I think, you know, the bare-knuckled political reality is that a lot of Republicans are afraid of being primaried out of their seats if they turn on the president or if he turns his mean tweets on them. But beyond that, I also think they sort of tell themselves that he's just, you know, tweeting, and that, you know, the real investigation and workings of the Justice Department are trundling along despite him, and so they don't really need to step in. And I think that when they do that, they're failing to understand how much damage is being done, how many longtime public servants are departing government now, operating in this environment, and what effect it's going to have on juries and witnesses out when, you know, the FBI goes and tries to interview someone and they've been hearing for months that the president thinks the FBI is corrupt. They're going to be less likely to cooperate, and real Americans are going to be affected when crimes don't get solved because people have lost faith in those institutions.
Well, apparently that's already happening in the courts across this country, where FBI agents testifying are now being looked upon by juries with skepticism.
Yeah, I mean, look, juries' jobs are to be somewhat skeptical, but they ought to presume the good faith of the law enforcement until proven otherwise. And, you know, if they're bringing in a bunch of extra baggage about the FBI on matters that have nothing to do with whatever the field office is that they're dealing with out in, you know, middle America, you know, that's really troubling, because we need to be able to trust our government. One of the, you know, if you sever the bonds of trust with the government, it's at a fundamental level. There are all sorts of collateral consequences that would come, and they would be quite damaging to the rule of law and to the enforcement of our laws that we rely on to protect us from crimes and violence, etc.
And again, I'm speaking with Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. So when you say that the DOJ is sort of trundling along, it seems to me that we are heading for some kind of collision, if not a crisis, because the president has ordered the declassification of secret work product involved in an ongoing investigation of which he himself, Donald Trump, might be a target. And this is placing unacceptable and impossible demands on the director of the FBI and the director of national intelligence. And either they're going to have to resign or make a stand. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, there's a number of problems with the president's declassification order. Number one is, as you noted, it seems to be animated by the president's self-interest rather than the national interest, which is a very big problem. But even further than that, it could, depending on the information, burn sources that, for example, Orr has been a longtime counterintelligence specialist on Russia matters, and he may know quite a bit about our intelligence network and where we get information about what the Russians are up to. And some of that material may be in these materials that are now subject to declassification review. That could be very damaging to us. Future people we were trying to convince to cooperate may be less likely to give us information if they're concerned that the president, in a fit of pique, is going to release their names to the public for the world to see. So those are, you know, significant issues. And even beyond that, it may be illegal under the Privacy Act or other statutory authorities for some of this information to be released without redactions. For example, if people have privacy interests that are covered by the Privacy Act, they could potentially be restricted from presidential determination that they should be released to the public. So, you know, I think there are quite a few problems here. And with respect to those leaders, they're going to have their sort of Donnybrook moment, and they're going to have to decide whether or not they're, if the president forges ahead with what they deem to be unlawful or supremely ill-advised orders, whether they're going to either refuse to obey them and make the president fire them, or whether they're going to resign in protest. And so, you know, they'll have to assess their own obligations under the Constitution and the oaths they've given to do so. But I hope they do so in a forthright way rather than writing an anonymous op-ed in the New York Times. I hope they look the president in the whites of his eyes and tell him that's unconstitutional, that's illegal, and I'm not going to do it.
But the added pressure on them, apart from the fact that their boss, the president, is telling them to do something that they don't want to do, and they know is possibly placing the lives of sources in danger and exposing methods. What's waiting in the wings is the Tea Party, or the so-called Freedom Caucus in the House, will then go ahead and call for impeachment of Christopher Wray and Senator Coates.
Well, you know, I think, like I said, this is one of those moments where you have to be willing to do your duty, even if that means consequences. And I think, you know, what we need to see right now is that the guiding star for them needs to be the law, starting with the Constitution and moving towards the statutes. And whatever consequences come from that, they should face them and be proud of honorable choices they've made along the way. But, you know, but I agree with you. There's real serious peril. And, you know, that's one of the reasons so much is riding on these midterm elections, to see who is going to have the political power in a whip count to be able to make sure that these institutions function as they're supposed to.
Well, it just sounds like a bit of a detour, Andy Wright, but recently when I was getting a haircut, you know how one sometimes learns about the rest of the world from your barber. In this case, my barber is a big watcher of Fox News and all this right-wing media, and he was going on about this Bruce Orr guy. Oh, my God, this Bruce Orr thing. It's so huge. And I thought, what the hell's he talking about? And, of course, in reality, Bruce Orr is one of the really valuable assets that the U.S. government has, because he's an expert on Russian organized crime. But he apparently got in the crosshairs a few months ago. And this happens periodically, that Fox and these other right-wing media outlets gin up these kinds of conspiracies, and they stick, as though, you know, this guy suddenly is the devil incarnate. And as far as I know, there's no there. That all Bruce Orr did to get Trump's ire was, apparently, Christopher Steele, the author of the infamous Steele dossier, apparently said to him once that he thinks Trump is guilty and is owned by the Russians. Why did he suddenly become this bête noir?
Well, you know, one of the strategies that the president's defenders have undertaken is they've tried to turn the Steele dossier into sort of a toxic document, a hot potato, if you will. And anyone who's touched it is then tainted. And so they've sort of gone after every person that they've found that has had any you know, contact with Steele or has moved the dossier around. And, you know, on the one hand, I think it's fair to raise questions about the dossier because it was unverified raw intelligence reports, and that's certainly something one ought to read with a skeptical eye. I think Christopher Steele, in some senses, wrote it with a skeptical eye. But on the other hand, I think it's also a document that ought to alarm people, and there is a reason that that document ended up under discussion, notwithstanding its most salacious allegations about the president's conduct. But I think it is something that would certainly be worthy of further investigation, especially coming from someone like Christopher Steele, who handled the Russia portfolio for British intelligence, someone who'd been cooperating with our government in the past. So it's not that his word is the gospel, but it's certainly a lead that would be worthy of follow-up. But the Republicans have been treating it as if anyone who has had any contact with that whole storyline has somehow disgraced themselves. And so that's how Bruce Orr seems to have gotten in the crosshairs. I gather his spouse may have had connections to Fusion GPS, which is another reason that they're trying to go after him. Although last time I checked, our spouses were allowed to have their own careers, and they're not necessarily imputed to us. And so, I'm not sure that's a fair charge.
Well, it seems more than a coincidence that the top intelligence officials who briefed the president-elect on January the 6th of 2017, a couple of weeks before President Trump was inaugurated, they've all gone into the crosshairs, much more so than Bruce Orr. Comey, we know, is sort of Trump's enemy number one. Brennan has now become Trump's enemy number one. I don't know, how many enemy number ones you can have. Clapper has also become enemy number one. It seems to me there's something very suspicious about that, that the very man who apparently provided Trump with unequivocal intelligence that was heavily sourced, involving very, very secret sources and methods in apparently granular detail how Russia interfered in our elections. And then there was a separate private briefing that Comey gave Trump about the Steele dossier to tell him that this is what's out there. So it just strikes me that there's something going on here. To my mind, if the president was innocent, perhaps even if he was what the Russians call a useful idiot and didn't know the extent to which he's been manipulating, he'd be the first person who'd want to clear the air to make sure that the American people understood that his election was legitimate. But he's taken the opposite attack. He's gone after the people who told him about these facts, and he's tried to sort of pretend that these facts aren't facts. And this is where we're at today. So do you think that January the 6th is a sort of key in the sense to understanding this tactic?
I think both the January 6th intelligence briefing for the president, as well as all the people who could corroborate Comey's account of his other inappropriate conversations with the president about loyalty, et cetera, they've all come under this kind of scrutiny and attack. And there was a report recently that the chairman of the Intelligence Committee told a room full of political supporters that they needed this information to be declassified so they could run on the idea that the corrupt Justice Department was engaged in a witch hunt and take that to the voters as part of their closing argument in the midterm election. So it's quite clear that this is part of a political defense, much more so than it is an actual legal inquiry into potential wrongdoing. Look, if Justice Department officials have engaged in misconduct, that ought to be referred to the Inspector General of the Justice Department or the Office of Professional Responsibility as appropriate and taken a look at. It shouldn't be something where the president's political advisors and other political hacks are taking it out and litigating it on Fox News.
But just in closing, there seems to be complete asymmetry between people like Devin Nunes and what they bring to the table. And frankly, as far as I can tell, he hasn't really brought anything to the table in terms of evidence that rebuts anything. On the other hand, you have so much evidence that every other day there's a new breaking story about Russian involvement. The former DNI General Clapper said, if you shake a tree, a Russian falls out of it. I mean, I just can't understand what the argument is on the other side. And every day that passes, there's a greater urgency to get to the bottom of the truth rather than to obscure the truth.
Well, it's a concern. And, luckily we have what seems to be a quite competent team in the Office of Special Counsel, Robert Mueller, that is methodically moving forward with their counterintelligence and criminal investigation. Unfortunately, I have less confidence in what's going on in Congress, even in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has had some bright spots during this period. But, Devin Nunes has had several iterations here where he's overpromised political fodder to the right when he's released things or had things declassified, and they've turned out to be own goals. And so we'll see, even after this what I think is an ill-advised classification drama. Once these documents come out, if they do come to light, they may not sell what was promised to begin with.
Well, Andy Wright, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andy Wright, who's a senior fellow and founding editor of Just Security, who served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the deal Russia's President Putin has made with Turkey's President Erdogan to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe on Turkey's southern border. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aaron Stein, who is the resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, and the Syria conflict. Dr. Stein is currently a doctoral fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, associate fellow for the Royal United Services Institute, and a researcher with the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies. He previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group in Istanbul and has published articles and reports on Turkey's nuclear capabilities and Turkish elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Stein.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Aaron. And what do you make of this deal that was put together by Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Turkey's President Erdogan? It seems to be it's been widely actually praised by all of the parties, from what I can tell. But there are it's very thin on details. And do you think it's workable?
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. I think at the 11th hour, as pressure increased on Turkey from the troika of the Iranians, the Russians, and the Syrian regime about launching an offensive in this pocket in northwestern Syria, is that the Turks agreed in writing to things that they had been telling the Russians that they would do, which is namely to try and deal with certain extremist groups in the area linked to Al-Qaeda elements, and to neutralize or at least make more palatable elements of the Syrian opposition to the Syrian regime, what I think is just part of a broader effort on the part of the Russians to try and de-escalate the conflict. Whether Turkey can actually deliver these things remains to be seen, and whether or not an offensive in this part of Syria will take place at a later date, I think is very much, you know, an open question and something that we'll have to see if it actually transpires and unfolds.
So, in other words, it looks more like the potential confrontation in Idlib has been postponed rather than eliminated.
Well, I mean, the Turks could, in an ideal scenario that would prevent violence, you know, uphold the letter of the law that they signed with the Russians. Or the Russians could, as the deadlines come forward, to disarm certain elements, certain opposition elements tied to Turkey, and to deal with the Al-Qaeda-linked insurgent problem in that area by the two dates Turkey has agreed to, which is in mid-October, maybe Turkey can do that. And you can forestall this a little bit longer. Maybe Russia can fudge at a little later date if there's progress to be made. But the fundamental issue is that Turkey, as an external power, is in northwestern Syria and is controlling from inside Syria elements of the Syrian border. And I just can't see how the Syrian regime will be able to tolerate this, you know, open-endedly and tolerate basically foreign powers controlling its borders when it thinks, no matter what the United States or foreign powers think about the Syrian regime, that it is legitimate in its fight and that it is winning its civil war.
So how are the 3 million civilians going to be separated from what I assume is a sort of hostage situation with these jihadist groups, particularly the latest incarnation of Jabhat al-Nusra, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and others that are al-Qaeda affiliated? They, you know, the minute that they would be separated from the 3 million innocent civilians who have gotten a sort of release on life, they're not going to be pounded to death in these buildings that they're in that are, you know, there were a couple of villages outside of Idlib have already been pounded. So is that, what's the arrangement there? In other words, if the goal is to protect 3 million Syrian civilians, how do come the jihadis went along with it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And these sort of jihadist groups have thus far, I mean, in public statements, come out and disavowed this deal and have said that this is tantamount to their capitulation and that Turkey and Russia are working to erode them. Their analysis isn't wrong, but there are jihadi groups and they will have to be dealt with. But I think that points to the broader issue that Turkey has to face is that now they're on the hook to try and separate perhaps some of the reconcilable groups that maybe bandwagon with some of these core al-Qaeda guys from core al-Qaeda to try and bring in to try and prevent regime bombardment and then to try and turn the opposition inwards on itself so that it fights al-Qaeda sort of as part of like an uprising within this area. This will be exceedingly difficult to do and should heed and should be a warning for any optimistic, rosy scenarios about Idlib. It should lead to certain pessimism. For the 3 million people who live there, Idlib has swelled with IDPs from elsewhere in Syria. It's also become the last refuge where in other places throughout Syria where the regime has forced opposition withdrawal, this is where they withdraw to, this pocket in the northwest. Turkey is obviously concerned that with a massive regime and Russian offensive is that these people will try and push across the Turkish border. And Turkey has said it's at max capacity and will no longer accept any more Syrians. And so they want to keep them in Syria, which adds another incentive to the Turkish government to try and reach agreements with the Russians and the regime that forestall and prevent a large-scale military operation. So Turkey is really trying to balance multiple competing interests here, and it's not an easy task that they've signed themselves up to. And we could easily see a lot of these agreements falling apart and then bombardment starting later and then concerns about mass movement of people towards the Turkish border.
And again, I'm speaking with Aaron Stein, who's a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, and the Syria conflict. He previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group in Istanbul and has published articles and reports on Turkey's nuclear capabilities and Turkish elections. Well, it seems that many people are already declaring Assad the victor, along with Russia and Iran. But there are some sort of still some serious wrinkles, if you will. Just yesterday, a Russian surveillance aircraft was shot down by Syrian anti-aircraft fire that was blamed initially on Israel. But then Netanyahu and Putin calmed things down. And what's pretty clear is that the Russians have given the Israelis a green light to go after the Iranians in Syria, and there's an arrangement there. So to that extent, you just talked about Assad ceding authority or not wanting to cede authority. My understanding is what Assad basically wants is for all the opposition people to be driven out of the country so that he essentially can declare victory and and only have this sort of ghost town of a country with his followers. Is that the long term? And by the way, somehow con the West into helping rebuild this country, which I would think that, you know, to the victor go the spoils, that the Russians and the Iranians should pick up the tab.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's much appetite for Western funding to try and rebuild what is essentially a destroyed country, largely at the hands of the Syrians and the Russians themselves. I do think that, you know, victory is a fungible and loose term in any civil conflict. The country has been at war with itself for 7 years, and even though Assad is clearly on the trajectory towards quote-unquote victory, I mean, what is he actually winning? He's winning a broken country with more people displaced than probably there are living inside the country, a massive refugee population, and a rebuilding effort that will not get much international support that will probably be inadequate. And so he's looking at a lot of trouble. And by the way, as you know, these, in, you know, if you want to call them insurgents or opposition, as they are eventually ousted from urban areas, they will move into rural areas. My expectation is that they will continue to carry out some sort of low-level insurgency against the Syrian government for the foreseeable future. And so while his authority is unquestioned inside of Syria, he's not a strong leader by any means. I mean, he's entirely dependent on his foreign benefactors. I mean, one thing he may do as being an entirely cynical actor is that he can try through Russian support to actually bring back certain refugees, which seems counterintuitive, but if you are able to bring back, or at least quote-unquote welcome some of these people who have been displaced, that could be a mechanism to try and win international funding. And if you can get international funding for refugee resettlement, is that you would therefore infer upon yourself more political legitimacy because foreign governments are working with you. Now, I don't think this is going to work. You know, the man will probably the man's probably committed genocide, and so you know, there will be extreme hesitation and caution to work with him on the part of any Western government. And so, yes, I think it'll be mostly left to the Russians and the Iranians to pick up the tab for a civil war that they've helped fuel by giving basically overt and open-ended support to a dictator that kills his own people.
So what does Turkey get out of it then? I mean, my understanding is that that Turkey would accept a certain amount of Syrian Sunnis there as a way to kind of drive the Kurds out of that buffer zone. And while Erdogan is making a deal with Putin, apparently he still believes that U.S. support for the Kurdish militia in northeast Syria are the biggest threat, and this is quoting Erdogan, to Syria's future.
Yeah, I mean, the Turkish priorities changed as it became clear with the Russian intervention that Assad would stabilize and hold power. And with the Russian bombardment, particularly of Syria's north, they effectively neutralized much of, you know, the Turkish-supported opposition that Ankara was backing to try and topple the regime. And as Turkey recalibrated, their interests became about keeping people out of Turkey and to prevent any sort of consolidation of Kurdish political empowerment inside of Syria. And to do that, they needed Russian support for cross-border military action. And so you had an entente with Moscow, and the two have become symbiotic actors in this conflict, you know, one of the fruits of which is this Idlib arrangement, despite having, you know, I guess, opposing allies on the ground, Turkey being, you know, the main supporter of the opposition and Russia being the main supporter of Assad. The two have found a way to work together on a narrow set of interests to try and make sure that, you know, their security concerns, each side, Turks and the Russians, are addressed through working together. The limits of this, as I sort of said earlier, will become apparent, I think, pretty soon. But the two sides have actually managed to foster pretty durable working relations despite all the challenges.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, does this mean, though, given that Turkey's relations with Russia are improving while they're deteriorating with their relations with the U.S., does this mean that the U.S. has been sidelined in the region by Russia's diplomatic initiatives?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of there's a tendency, particularly in Washington where I live, you know, to ascribe a sort of level of tactical genius to Putin that he does not have. You know, if we step back, I mean, the Russians are clearly the dominant actor in Syria, but the United States is there too and has a level of flexibility because it's not so deeply enmeshed in the conflict as the Russians are. I mean, the Russians have been involved in open-ended military conflict in Syria with their own boots on the ground and their own air power for 3 years, and they're still unable to settle the conflict entirely on their own terms. And so, like, he's falling short, he being Vladimir Putin, in terms of being able to dictate outcomes and having to make compromises. Clearly, they're doing a good job in managing all these contradictions, but those contradictions involve. If you sort of look around the region, you know, Russia still remains the lesser of the two powers compared to the U.S. But Russian positions in the Middle East have certainly, sort of in a very naked geopolitical terms, certainly increased and gotten more pronounced as compared to, say, 10 years ago. And so, yes, he's on the upward trajectory, but, you know, that's more or less from an artificial rock bottom post-Cold War towards maybe a very small sort of scale return to some of the status quo that was in place, you know, before Russia's economic collapse in the 1990s.
Well, I guess a conversation for another day is to speculate on what the U.S. got out of the $5 trillion or so that we've invested in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and, to some extent, Syria. A conversation for another day, but I thank you for joining us, Aaron Stein.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Stein, who's a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, and the Syria conflict. He previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group in Istanbul and has published articles and reports on Turkish nuclear capabilities and Turkish elections. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Down.